Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the article of impeachment against President Donald Trump, filed today for the first time in the House of Representatives, accusing Trump of high crimes and misdemeanors for obstructing justice by firing James Comey to stop the Russian investigation and pressuring him to drop the FBI investigation into Michael Flynn. A senior member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Brad Sherman, who introduced an article of impeachment, joins us to discuss why he did so and what the grounds are for doing so, even though few Democrats in the House are joining in the effort that the Republican majority will not act on and could easily reject the resolution. But in doing so, they would put all members on record as to how they feel about impeaching Trump. Then we will speak with the author of an important new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean, Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, joins us to discuss her latest book, Just Out, which explains how we got to the current situation where just two plutocrats, the Koch brothers, appear to have captured the Congress and are having their agenda enacted at the expense of the American people. She explains how James Buchanan, an economist out to preserve white privilege in the Jim Crow South, figured out a way to deploy plutocratic power while preventing the majority of Americans from using their voting power to better their lives. Then finally, with today's nationwide protests against the Trump-appointed head of the FCC, Ajit Pai, which has giant corporations like Facebook, Twitter, and Google supporting the internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality, we will speak with a former FCC commissioner, Michael Copps. He joins us to discuss what is at stake in preserving internet freedom and the urgent need to mobilize grassroots action to stop the Trump administration's undemocratic push by corporate power via their lackey, Ajit Pai, to deny the will of the vast majority of Americans who don't want the internet cableized with telecom monopolies controlling internet content. And joining us now is Congressman Brad Sherman, who represents California's San Fernando Valley in the U.S. House of Representatives, serving his 10th term in Congress. He's a senior member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and serves on as the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Asia and is the former chairman of the Subcommittee on International Terrorism, Nonproliferation, and Trade. He's also a senior member of the Financial Services Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Brad Sherman.
Good to be with you.
And Congressman, today you introduced or filed articles of impeachment against Donald Trump in the House of Representatives. That is a pretty big move, right?
It's not unexpected. I circulated proposed articles of impeachment early last month. I've been working to study the issue further to fine-tune the document. This was our first day back in session after the July 4th break, and it was time to actually submit the articles.
And this is the first time that anybody submitted articles, right? You essentially have been floating this idea. Is that to say that you haven't had support from your caucus?
Well, I do have one co-sponsor, but I think a majority of my caucus would like to see investigations and a Judiciary Committee hearing on high crimes and misdemeanors, on obstruction of justice. But the exact draft that I put together is sponsored by myself and co-sponsored by Al Green of Texas.
And at the heart of it is something that I think is in plain sight, is it not? And that is the firing of Comey does look to be obstruction of justice, because the president in an NBC interview more or less said the reason why he fired him was to get out from under this Russia investigation. So is that at the heart of the articles that you've introduced today in the Congress?
At the heart is obstruction of justice as defined in Section 1512b3. And there are two elements. One that you outlined, which is there was an ongoing investigation of the Russian scandal in general, and the president fired Comey and then said the next day that by doing so, he had liberated himself from that investigation. The second is that he knew that Comey wanted to keep his job, told him, hey, lots of other good people want your job, and threatened Comey by telling him that he ought to curtail the investigation of Michael Flynn. And when didn't curtail that investigation, he fired him. Both of these seem to be clear instances of obstruction of justice by the president himself. And then the recent revelations that the president had every reason to want to obstruct the Russia investigation. Not that necessarily he personally engaged in collusion, but clearly his son engaged in activity that is not helpful. Simply adds to the argument that this was indeed obstruction of justice, and it and the linchpin of the two issues is the firing and threatening of James Comey.
But the revelation from the New York Times, which forced Donald Trump Jr. to release the chain of emails, hardly exonerate him, if not incriminate him. And the meetings that took place, we don't know what those meetings were about. We know what was said in setting up the meetings, and that is pretty incriminating, that a representative of the Russian government is coming to bring dirt on Hillary Clinton, and this is being done at the behest of the Russian government, who want to help elect Mr. Trump. And this meeting took place, what, one floor below where Donald Trump was, and the meeting included his son, Donald Jr., and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his campaign manager, Paul Manafort. So it's hard not to believe that they didn't at least brief the president. What's your take on that?
I have no proof that they briefed the president. I lived through Watergate, where we learned it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. It's not the collusion, it's the cover-up. It's not the failure of Michael Flynn to disclose hundreds of thousands of dollars from Turkey and Russia. It's the cover-up. And obstruction of justice is the legal term for cover-up. I do not know whether the president personally tried to get information from Russia, but I do know that he fired Comey and thought that that liberated him from an investigation which would have disclosed then what has been disclosed now, and that is that Donald Trump Jr. engaged in highly questionable activities that the Trump campaign wished never came to light.
And vigorously denied ever happened. And that isn't that the pattern here, though? They deny that they meet with the Russian ambassador, and then we find out later, and they say, whoops, and then they fix up their security clearance forms to add meetings that took place that they didn't initially expose?
One can imagine forgetting a meeting with an ambassador. I meet with at least 100, it seems, every year, if I include ambassadors and other foreign ministry officials. But Michael Flynn forgot hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't forget that. And it's we'll have to see whether there was real collusion with the Kremlin, and particularly collusion with regard to stolen property, or the either the act of stealing it or its disposition, because the files stolen from the DNC are stolen property. The interesting parallels here is back in the 1972, files were stolen from the Democratic National Committee. And back then, files were manila folders in file cabinets. Now, we have files stolen from the Democratic National Committee. But in today's world, files are electrons on a hard drive. And the other parallel between this and Watergate is it's you may not be able to show that the crime or possible crime was authorized or engaged in by the president, but you may be able to show that the cover-up was engaged in by the president. And there are elements to obstruction of justice. They're laid out in the code. And the two instances I've discussed with you clearly fit Section 1512b3.
And again, I'm speaking with Congressman Brad Sherman, who represents California's San Fernando Valley in the U.S. House of Representatives, serving his 10th term in Congress. He's a senior member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and serves as the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Asia and is the former chairman of the Subcommittee on International Terrorism, Nonproliferation and Trade. He's also a senior member of the Financial Services Committee. And today he filed articles of impeachment in the U.S. House of Representatives against President Donald Trump. Well, clearly the Watergate break-in was a physical attack on the DNC, and this latest Russian attack has been an electronic attack. But I don't believe we've ever had the equivalent of a kind of Pearl Harbor attack on the very foundation of American democracy itself. It's clear that the Russians were prepared to interfere with our elections, literally in terms of their ability to alter totals, etc. They did exploratory hacking, which is pretty clear. So that is what I find mystifying, is why is it that a lot of the conservative Republicans who used to be, some of them were red betas and most of them were communist haters, now are making excuses for Putin and the Russians. And even on the left, you have some people like Oliver Stone effectively making excuses for Putin. The whole concept of American patriotism seems to have been turned on its head.
Well, as far as we know, the totals were not altered. And as far as we know, the Trump campaign was not trying to get those totals altered. It is critically important that all of our voting systems from coast to coast have a paper auditable trail. And many states, I think California is on the right side of this, but many states have embraced an all-electronic technology that is not only subject to Russian manipulation, but that manipulation would be undetectable and the results would be unauditable and the damage would be irreparable. So we've done some, but we need to do more to make sure that every ballot has a piece of paper that cannot be erased and is subject to security throughout the whole entire process, including any necessary recount.
But I'm more or less echoing what Comey said in his testimony, where he was just dismayed that the president had no interest in looking into the Russian hacking. And he basically was warning everybody on the Intelligence Committee that they're coming at us again and nothing is being done. I'm just curious to try and figure out what is all this denial about?
Well, it's not an impeachable offense to be less vigorous than he should be in mm-hmm. preventing future Russian hacking of our electoral system. It is a tragic and wrongful mistake. And draws questions to all of our foreign policy with regard to Russia. There are benefits and detriments to this, but we have a very decentralized election process. The one thing we need to keep is every process in every county needs to have an auditable trail that is not subject to hacking, manipulation, et cetera. And the idea that votes can't be tampered with, just look at the Texas Senate elections of the 1940s and you come to a very different conclusion.
And just before you go, what about Mike Pence? But
all I can say is I served with him for 12 years, and I disagree with him on just about everything. But we need a constitutional government that follows the rule of law.
Thank you for joining us.
I look forward to talking to you again.
And I've just been speaking with Congressman Brad Sherman, who represents California's San Fernando Valley in the House of Representatives, serving his 10th term in Congress. He's a senior member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and serves as the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Asia and is the former chairman of the Subcommittee on International Terrorism, Nonproliferation and Trade. He's also a senior member of the Financial Services Committee. And today he filed articles of impeachment in the U.S. House of Representatives against President Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the author of the important new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. It's the institution.
Anyone, anyhow. Don't you know it's coming?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nancy MacLean, the award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University and the author of a brand new book just out, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy MacLean.
Delighted to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Nancy. And your book could not be more important. On the 4th of July program I did recently, I explored the notion of whether we are, on the day that we celebrate democracy, whether we are still a democracy or have become a plutocracy.
Yes.
And I must say that I had the author of Oligarchy on, and former chief economist for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. And there was no question in either of the guests' mind that we have become a plutocracy. But what you are telling us is you've laid out the history of how we became a plutocracy. And that's, I think, incredibly valuable.
Thank you.
So let's get started and break it all down and fill our audience in. This is something that they really have to understand. And obviously, having figured out how it happened, then we have to figure out how to undo it. But let's begin with the idea that this 60-year campaign to make this sort of libertarian Koch brothers kind of control of our politics happen, it wasn't just that the wealthy plutocrats had some devious plan in hand. They were actually led to this plan, and they provided the money. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the person who basically is responsible for the intellectual ammunition behind the plutocratic takeover of the United States.
Yeah, as you pointed out, they did not have a plan. And when this my story starts in 1956, and the libertarians, you know, you could count them in the hundreds, and they were very marginal to public debate, and they had trouble persuading anybody of their ideas. Their first candidate that they were enthused about was Barry Goldwater, who bombed everywhere but the Deep South, where so many voters were disenfranchised, and his own home state of Arizona. And that pattern kept repeating itself. That they could not figure a way to break through. And Charles Koch began reading into and becoming part of this tradition in the 60s and followed all these failures that included the Reagan administration. Even Ronald Reagan pulled back from the brink when he understood how devastating this agenda would be to America, and that even his own Republican voters would never forgive him if he made the kind of cuts they were talking about. So they had this repeated pattern of failure. And so Charles Koch, by his own admission, spent decades looking for the ideas that would help him break through. And he supported hundreds of scholars and intellectuals. And by the late 1990s, 1997, in fact, he believed that he had gotten what he called the technology to help him break through. He has three engineering degrees from MIT. He's a very brilliant man. And he thinks about ideas as technology. And the technology that he found was the understanding of political economy developed by this man named James McGill Buchanan, who features prominently in the first two-thirds of my book until Charles Koch takes over and kind of pushes him aside. But what James Buchanan supplied was a way of looking at government and public life that corresponded to the libertarian cynicism about democracy and about other people in our society, but that also in time created the basis for producing a kind of a roadmap or a blueprint for how to quite literally undermine the liberal state that had been built up over the course of the 20th century. So this is a cause that is not only about undoing the environmental movement or the civil rights movement or the women's movement or the labor movement or old age retirement security along the lines of Social Security. It's going back through the progressive era. They want to go back to about 1900. That's the model that James Buchanan upheld, and that's the kind of model that Charles Koch is promoting. So my kind of summary way of thinking about this is that James Buchanan supplied the ideas and Charles Koch supplied the money that enabled those ideas to go operational in the way we've seen so dramatically since 2010.
So going back, in effect, to the earlier Gilded Age, and now, of course, we are in the new Gilded Age, thanks to the roadmap that Buchanan provided and the money that Charles Koch and other plutocrats and there's incredibly strategic use of this money. But it's worth reminding us, surely, that it was as recently as the 1970s that the Liberals controlled the House by massive margins, the Senate by massive margins, the Supreme Court by massive margins. Did they lose heart? I mean, I know they were up against a formidable force with all of this strategy and money, but what happened to the Liberals?
That's a great question, and a really important question as we try to think about how to get our way out of here. I will say that one thing that James Buchanan built his reputation on that is hugely important is a fundamental problem in modern democracies, and it's actually a problem that conservatives have consistently exacerbated, but it's a real problem. Here's the problem. The problem is that people want lots of things from government. We want clean air and water. We want an end to discrimination. We want safe products. We want good roads. We want schools that will prepare us for opportunity. We want all of these things, but we don't like to pay for them, right? And some of our, you know, even our humor about, you know, the only certain things in life are death and taxes. You know, there is a unwillingness to pay taxes, particularly among the wealthy, but not only among the very right-wing wealthy like Charles Koch. And that means that governments go into deficit because, and Buchanan, you know, was an analyst of this, and he made his reputation on this issue of explaining deficits. So that problem is a problem that afflicted Democrats and in office as much as it has Republicans. And it was in the 1970s that all of this really came to a crisis point. And in that crisis point, many Democrats, too, I mean, I'm not following them as much in my work, but some Democrats were certainly affected by some of this thinking, and particularly the Southern Democrats associated with the Democratic Leadership Council, Bill Clinton most prominently among them, but others, too, including Al Gore and others. And so their strategy for dealing with this problem of deficits and of the public's unwillingness to pay taxes and so forth was partly also, they were just kind of reorienting the Democratic Party. So they really kind of pushed labor aside, you know, and did not support workers' rights to collective bargaining in the same way that earlier generations of Democrats had. And so our labor unions began to be hobbled. I mean, they made plenty of their own mistakes, too, granted, but the Democrats dropped the ball many times when they could have helped labor. They also embraced free trade wholeheartedly, free trade on employers' terms, you know, with the NAFTA agreement, and that, you know, undercut so many good blue-collar jobs in America, and you know, workers were not protected from that. So there's a lot of things that Democrats did that contributed to the mess that we're in, and that, frankly, ordinary citizens did, too, because we weren't thinking forwardly enough or engaging one another enough. So there's plenty of blame, if you will, to go around. But I would say one of the things that Democrats have done in recent years that is absolutely the most destructive is to embrace this campaign for charter schools and for vouchers and for what has become the undermining of public education. And I'm sorry to say that I think some of that has to do with the power of the financial industry in the Democratic Party, because there's so many hedge fund investors and others who are eager to get the profits that would come from the huge profits that would come from the privatization of the education industry, as they call it, and they're already speculating on it. Mm-hmm. So I think in all of those ways, I think Democrats and, you know, sort of more mainstream liberals also played a part in bringing us to the fairly dire situation we're in right now.
Right, where instead of our children being centers of investment, they have become centers of profit, and they're indentured before they even get a job. Again, I'm speaking with Nancy MacLean, the award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University and the author of the brand new book just out, Democracy and Change, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. So let's just go back to the reality that not only are we a plutocracy, but we actually are a country, in effect, that has two plutocrats have largely taken over. They pretty much control the House, most of the state legislatures, and the Senate. And that, of course, explains the disconnect at the moment that they're having with this so-called repeal and replacement of health care, because it's really a tax cut for wealthy. And, of course, the Kochs want a permanent tax cut coming up soon. And everything that...
If I may say, though, I think there's even more strategy to what's going on in this healthcare situation. And also the healthcare situation is really revealing of the kind of dynamics that I'm talking about in the book, because the technology that Charles Koch, you know, as he put it, the ideas he got from James Buchanan included a close attention to the incentives and penalties of public life and how those could be tweaked to advance a program. And so what, informed by Buchanan's ideas, what the Koch team has done is to change the incentives and the rewards. And one of the things they've done is to do this pretty profound attack on the right of workers to organize and have representation in politics, particularly teachers unions, but all public sector worker unions. And that was something Buchanan was advocating from the mid-1970s. He said public sector workers shouldn't even be able to vote. So I think we can see that together with some of the voter suppression measures as you know, kind of a fruit of those ideas. But the other thing that they have really understood, these very, very wealthy right-wing donors, and I do want to say they're a fraction of the wealthy. I mean, I don't think all the wealthy people agree with them either, or all corporate leaders. So, but this is just, you know, a group of billionaires like Charles Koch and the donor network he's pulled around. And what they have come to understand from paying attention to Buchanan's public choice political economy is that they can change the incentives in politics. So what they've done, and you see this in the Affordable Care Act, is they are using huge pots of this donor dark money to hold politicians accountable to the donors, not to their voters. And they felt like they had to change that because, as I said earlier, politicians kept responding to citizens, even when they shared these ideas at the level of rhetoric, such as Ronald Reagan. So what these donors are doing, and you see happening in the case of healthcare, is that the donors, convened by Koch and represented in the Freedom Caucus and so forth, they just want to take away healthcare. They don't want the government to provide any healthcare. That is not popular with most Americans. In fact, it polls terribly. And so what the donors are doing is using their money and the threat of primary challenges to force the politicians to be, the Republican politicians in particular, now to be accountable to them rather than the voters. And you see that pressure happening in, I mean, and most of the Republican politicians have complied and are you know, going along with the Senate bill that is so odious to most American voters. But the ones that are really subject to pressure from their home states, such as in Nevada, are finding that if they listen to their voters, the Kochs are saying, we will punish you. And actually, one of them said at the recent Koch Donor Network meeting, the piggy banks will be closed until you take away health care and get these changes in taxation. So it's that open a bullying by the donors that is making all of this work. And that is a real, you know, I mean, it's shocking, I think, when you think about it in those straightforward terms, but that is a shrewd and calculated effort. And it's, I think it's about much more than just a tax cut. I think it's about reshaping our political economy in fundamental ways. Right. And frankly, making this country unrecognizable to most of us. The country that would be bequeathed to our children and our grandchildren would look so different from what we've seen over the last 120 years if they succeed, and that's what they are trying to achieve.
And they are making great strides because effectively our politics are about money. So he who has the most money wins the race, and the Supreme Court in Citizens United have basically allowed this situation of money to dictate, and they have raised an awful lot of money. And the point I was trying to make, though, which ties into what you've just told us, is that the proof is in the pudding here, that everything that has been passed so far during this brief Trump administration has been the Koch brothers' agenda, crippling the EPA, getting out of the Paris Accords, opening up the tar sands oil, opening up offshore drilling, the tax cut in the healthcare plan and the big tax cut.
Privatizing public education,
So there is this disconnect between what the people want and what the Koch brothers want, but the Koch brothers have the clout to intimidate these politicians into enacting their agenda at the expense of the American people. So that's the situation we have. So my sense is that your book should be the wake-up call here. I mean, we can't go on pretending we're in a democracy and saluting the flag and having 4th of July picnics and all of the very history of this country. As you say, it'll be unrecognizable in a few years if these people get away with their agenda.
I agree with you that this situation is very serious and we need to pay attention because this cause is aiming for permanent change. And they believe that they are very close. And if they push through any more of this agenda, it's going to be almost impossible to reverse it for possibly generations. So it is very, very serious. On the other hand, I think the most dangerous thing now would be panic. And I think that these people on the right have tried to provoke all kinds of even physical confrontations, you know, say by sending out these incendiary speakers to universities and then the students react and blah, 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 blah. So I think it's very important for people to take a deep breath, think very clearly about what's going on, and remember that we still do have fundamental elements of our democracy still in place and that we need to use those. We do still have the freedom of speech. We do still have the capacity to organize. We do still have many, many organizations that have been built up and are doing good work in the resistance to this agenda. So I think we need to, you know, I also teach about the history of social movements, you know, and one thing that social movements have to think about as they go forward is not only what are our grievances and what's the problem that we're up against, but what are our resources. And I think there are some pretty impressive resources that we have if we begin to talk to one another in a different way with an understanding of where this came from and where it's going and start working together to address it. Because it is true, I think, that the, you know, whatever you want to call it, the progressive, liberal, moderate, whatever, you know, groups in America have been in silos for a very long time, you know, so that the civil libertarians don't pay attention to what's happening to the labor people sometimes. And some of the labor people didn't care about what was happening to the immigrant rights groups for a long time, although that has certainly changed. You know, the feminist groups have not been as connected with the environmentalists. You know, you could go on and on. But one thing that is just so extraordinary about this radical right bid for power in our country is that it has the capacity to bring all of those groups together, because anybody who has depended on the power of democracy, on our ability to speak together, to persuade one another, to bring majorities around to the view that we need changes, that is endangered for all of us now, wherever, whatever our starting point. And so I think, and it's also, by the way, this is a project that is antithetical to every religious tradition, you know, in their basic values. So I think that that is a really interesting starting point that could maybe enable people to begin to work together and work differently and work smarter if they want to protect our democracy and keep it from becoming fully a plutocracy.
Well, of course, the religious component should. There should, the religious left should rise up, as it did, by the way, in the last Gilded Age under William Jennings Bryan. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they've been captured by the right. Mike Pence and Betsy DeVos are, I mean, mm-hmm. what happened, obviously, was that Trump had to turn to them in order to get elected. And no Republican right. can get elected without the Christian vote. And a part of that deal was Mike Pence. And it's worth noting that on election night in Trump Tower, who was Trump sitting, watching, along with his family, watching the returns come in? Charles Koch and Peter Thiel, the libertarian from Silicon Valley.
Really? I never heard that before.
Oh, yeah. They,
wow.
They were there sharing it that evening.
Wow. Well, now I know Peter Thiel, who has made clear that he does not, he thinks democracy, I mean, capitalism is much more important than democracy, right. and he actually doesn't like the idea of women voting, as some other libertarians have said, because they right. think women are too pro-government, because we think about the consequences of ideas.
Right.
But I had not heard that, but I do know Peter Thiel, I believe, was the biggest donor to Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce and the kind of Koch network, and he was a Trump supporter, you know, early Trump supporter. So I actually do believe, I mean, I don't want to go too far down this road. I'm a historian and not a journalist, but I think, you know, the reporting on the Trump phenomenon really misled a lot of the public, I think, because journalists, so many journalists in our country and news editors have attention deficit disorder, so they imagine that the Koch story was the story of the year, you know, 2015, and that the Trump story is the story of 2016 and 2017 without really understanding how deeply those are connected. And as you say, you know, whatever the relationship between Trump and that network or the lack of it before, the truth is, once he got in office, who had the power and the resources to surround him? It was the Koch network. And so by one researcher's tally, 70% of his senior appointments, Trump's senior appointments, have come out of the Koch operations. And as you said, that includes Mike Pence. It also includes Mick Mulvaney, the director of the budget. It includes Scott Pruitt at the EPA. You know, you could just go on. Mark Short, who's the White House liaison to Congress, focusing on what legislation to move and how. So these operations now are deeply interconnected, and so many people from the Koch operations are staffing the Trump administration that we need to be able to tell these stories together and understand how they connect if we're going to do anything. So what I've been saying to people, too, is the most important thing progressives can do, frankly, I think, is stop focusing on Trump. You know, ignore his tweets. They're only distractions. Stop focusing so much attention on the Russia story. There are people investigating that, and it's important, but they will find it, and it makes citizens passive spectators, when in fact, on so many different fronts, the Trump administration and these there are literally hundreds of Koch-funded organizations are day-to-day pushing an agenda that will harm all of us in our local communities, at the state level, and at the federal level. So I think that's what people need to really home in on and not be distracted by just watching and commenting on the spectacle of Donald Trump.
And indeed, you know, having an investment in impeachment as opposed to being active, as you point out, I mean, there's no question in an ironic sense that the Russian investigation has driven Trump into the hands of Paul Ryan and the Koch brothers control Congress because he needs them to prevent an impeachment. And waiting in the wings, of course, is the Koch brothers candidate, Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. So in effect, we should be, you're right, we should ignore Trump and be worried about Pence, the next guy. But there's so much to talk about, and I really appreciate you joining us, and thank you for joining us, Nancy McLean.
Thank you so much for having me, and you're right that the book is a wake-up call. I will say I've gotten wonderful notes and communications from people around the country who are, you know, I think people have been watching this, trying to figure it out, trying to act on it for a long time, and now I think some conversations are really starting around the country in which people are starting to see what's happening and the cohesiveness of it and try to think, you know, about how better to deal with it. So I do hope you're right about the wake-up call.
And again, I've been speaking with Nancy McLean, the award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University and the author of the new book just out, Democracy and Change, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the nationwide protests in the internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality.
I'll get ready to call, just like Humpty Dumpty. I'm going to fall, and I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along, yes, rolling along. Don't want any million, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, just one, that's all I can wear. A bundle of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Copps.
I'm delighted to be on with you. Thank you.
Well, you're on this day of action to preserve net neutrality, and some of the biggest companies in the world are weighing in. Alphabet, which is Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, Netflix, etc. They're all weighing in on just one person, the FCC commissioner, or the head of the FCC, Ajit Pai, who was appointed by President Donald Trump in January. So is this enough? The most powerful companies on the planet. I mean, Google's market capitalization is, I think, at least two times that of ExxonMobil's. But this is not necessarily an easy battle, is it?
This is a very difficult battle, an uphill battle. We certainly welcome the support of the companies that you mentioned and many, many others. Even more important than that, though, in my book, is what we hear from mainstream America. I understand there are already 5.6 million messages into the FCC on this issue of net neutrality, the overwhelming majority in favor of maintaining strong network neutrality rules, and that tracks with what the polls are telling us, too, right now. So more than anything, I think, and we've seen this before with other instances that we can talk about, it's that pressure from the grassroots that will hopefully make a difference. Whether it will make sufficient difference to change Ajit Pai's approach to net neutrality, I don't know. He's very, very dug in on this issue. He wants to get rid of net neutrality protections. So I don't know if 5 or 10 or 15 million messages would do it, but I'm hoping that people are copying their representatives in Congress, too, so that they understand this is an issue, because there's talk up there of action, too. So I think it's a very, very important day, and so far from everything I've heard, it's been a very productive day. Now the challenge will be to keep the pressure on the commission and on the Hill. And particularly important is the role of the media in making sure that this story is covered on an ongoing basis. So that it's not a one day story that maybe makes the business section or hopefully makes the front section, but will be something of continuing importance, because this is one of the not only most contentious matters facing the country right now, but one of the most important. Whether this internet of the future, which should be a bosom friend of expanding democracy, which should be our town hall of democracy paved with broadband bricks, is going to be allowed to do that, or whether we're going to turn it over to gatekeepers who can block sites, throttle sites, and favor their business allies and give them fast lanes and us slow lanes. It's hugely important for the future of the news and information that our people receive, hugely important for the future of self-government. As a country, we haven't made a lot of really great decisions in the last little bit here, and we better figure out how to do better and how to participate and get some policies that will encourage good things to happen.
Well, it's pretty clear that in the Trump era, and it hasn't even been 6 months, that almost everything that has passed, and a lot of work has been done behind the scenes on changing rules and regulations and doing, as Stephen Bannon, the White House strategist, said, deconstructing the regulatory state.
Right.
It's pretty clear to me that this is a government, particularly a House and Senate, that's operating at the behest of powerful people like the Koch brothers and not the American people. So even if you give Ajit Pai the benefit of the doubt that he actually has some ideological, personal, thought-out, rational reasons for doing what he's doing, it's hard not to notice that he's doing the bidding of the big monopolies like Verizon, etc.
This would not even be an issue but for the huge amounts of money that big telecom and big media have put into the political bloodstream. There was this a survey that came out from Maplite just a couple of days ago. They're one of the outfits that really focuses on things like that. So this, and they calculate that since 2008, the three largest internet service providers, that would be Comcast and AT&T and Verizon, and the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, which is the industry association now run by a former chairman of the FCC, in the last 8 years, they have spent $572 million lobbying Congress on these issues. Imagine that. That's over $500 million. If it wasn't for that money, I don't think this would be an issue. It's contentious inside Washington, D.C., but around the country, All the polls are telling us now that over 70, up to 80% of the people, Republicans and Democrats, support keeping network neutrality because people want to be their own masters on the Internet. They don't want gatekeepers telling them where they can go or we're going to block some content and not others and all of the rest of that. It's a free speech issue. And this net neutrality is kind of the First Amendment issue of the open Internet.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and is currently heading the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Well, it's pretty clear that what will happen if Ajit Pai has his way and does the bidding of these big telecom companies, that you will end up having an internet that's like the cable service you have.
There's no competition.
You basically got choices between two lousy services. It's called the poverty of choice, where you get stuff that they give you that you don't necessarily want, and they keep charging you tons and tons of money. So the model for what happens with cable becomes the model for the internet itself. It's not hard to see how governments can make absolutely drastically bad decisions that really affect the entire country. For example, Australia had a national broadband plan, and the one government that pushed it wanted to do a fiber optic cable internet across the country. At the last minute, another government comes in this case, the Conservative government. They decided to save money, so they kept the copper wire infrastructure, and now Australia has one of the slowest broadband in the world. And it's totally stifling that country's economic growth. We know that if you have high-speed internet, which other countries have, like Japan, South Korea, even France, you get incredible productivity. Little towns like Santa Monica here in Los Angeles, they've turned to a gigabyte. Chattanooga, Tennessee. So the writing's on the wall, but this is just really an example of the power of monopolies to create a situation where they don't have to be competitive and they have the consumer over a barrel and they just soak them dry and they charge them more for lousy service. And that's where we're heading. So, you know, it's time to get the pitchforks out, for God's sake.
Well, I think you're right. We're talking here about the corporatization and the cableization of the internet, which was designed to be the most open and dynamic communications technology tool in all of history, with power at the edges and consumers and citizens figuring out where they're going to go and what content and what applications to run and all the rest. These companies are ridiculous. They're talking now about monopoly markets, and there's plenty of monopoly markets and oligopoly markets across the United States of America, and they want power over distribution, and now they're all becoming content companies too. And if that's not the classic definition of monopoly, you control the distribution and you control the product and the content, I don't know what is and why we should be fighting this fight, which I thought we'd pretty much settled back in the progressive era over 100 years ago. Why we're fighting this now is ridiculous. You can't have monopoly markets and no oversight. There'll be no competition, no good service. And most important of all, they'll be cutting back the news and the information. And journalism has already taken too many blows. It hangs by a thread. And then you're playing fast and loose with the ability of our country to govern itself, with the ability of the people to cast intelligent votes for the future. So this is so critical an issue. You know, we have so many issues out there, and they're all important. But you ought to put this issue of media reform and open internet and all that rest right up on top, because those other issues aren't going to go anywhere until people get more and better information and the facts about them, not just shouted opinion, but facts and real investigative journalism. So to me, I don't know of any more important issue facing our citizens right now.
Well, could you explain, Michael Copps, just so that we get the kind of framework here of this argument, what happened in 2015 when the Obama administration ruled to protect net neutrality under Title II, and what they're trying to undo now, and why they're trying to undo it.
Right. Well, under Chairman Wheeler, and it should have happened before that, and it took 4 million Americans writing into the Democratic-led commission at that time, and the President of the United States going on record in favor of strong net neutrality, too. So they finally passed a good set of net neutrality rules, which said people ought to be treated equally. No favoritism on the Internet. The big companies should not be able to block or to throttle content or websites that they might not like, but that people might want to see. Big companies should not be able to offer paid prioritization, whereby their business friends or their affiliates can pay to get really fast lanes on the Internet, and the rest of us suffer through with the slow lanes and the result that you just cited that was taking place down in Australia. So these were good rules, and the court has now twice upheld them since then. The Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia said, fine, if you want to have net neutrality rules, you have to have these strong ones that the Wheeler Commission passed, so-called Title II regulations, and then that was appealed to an en banc, the entire circuit court, and they said the same thing again. And the court also told us that back in 2014 when Chairman Jenikowski, Obama's first FCC chairman, came up with a weak set of rules that was not based on Title II. And the court said, if you're going to have net neutrality rules, you do it under Title II, you don't do it at all. That's what these companies are trying to get rid of now. They're trying to get rid of any government oversight. They're trying to get the way open for the monopoly practice and to make sure that they're the gatekeepers of the Internet. And if that doesn't go in the opposite direction of what the Internet was supposed to be, I don't know what does.
Well, but then let's go back to the Congress, which is in many ways, you know, wholly owned, if not partially owned, by the Koch brothers and a few plutocrats who seem to that, because all the agenda that's been passed so far is clearly the agenda of the Koch brothers. And, you know, so we know that we have a real problem with our democracy at the fundamental level. But this seems to be such an in-your-face, clear example of where powerful moneyed interests, corporate interests, basically put their guy in, and he's going to rule against the American people. And you've already cited the polls. I think it's right. 80% of Democrats want net neutrality and 73% of Republicans. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Well, there you have
been
it.
A number of polls.
Right. So that's unquestionably a majority of the American people, right?
Absolutely.
But they are not being listened to. The corporate interests are. So let's then talk about the people that organized this demonstration today, the internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality. These powerful corporations like Facebook, Twitter, Alphabet, Amazon, Netflix, etc. If it's a question of buying the Congress, which clearly the Koch brothers and Verizon and Comcast have, you said they spent $500 million. Can't these guys with more money buy it back? I mean, give me a sense of whether there's another strategy apart from throwing money at our Congress people to do the right thing.
Well, our strategy is to throw grassroots support. Our strategy is to have people meet these congressmen and senators when they go back to their districts and states and bring this issue up at town meetings. I saw this happen back in 2003 and 2007 when I was doing battle with then Chairman Powell and Chairman Martin as they were trying to loosen media ownership rules so these huge companies could buy up more and more properties. And millions of people wrote in, and I talked to members of Congress at that time who went home to their districts, and they said, you know, I was home a week or so ago, and people were bringing up this media ownership issue. I didn't know that was an issue out on the district. And that congressman came back and voted to cancel those rules that the Powell Commission had passed. So it does make a difference. We're not going to get any gifts out of Washington, D.C., I don't think, in the next 3.5 to 4 years, or maybe longer than that. If we're going to have reform, it's going to have to come from where genuine reform comes from. That's from the grassroots, and not people just watching this play out, but people who actively participate, these are the ones who are affected by net neutrality. People who are trying to organize or to spread their own message, which might be anti-corporate a lot of the time, and they don't want to be blocked or throttled or stopped. So I think it's grassroots right now, and try to keep bad things from happening. That's what we managed to do back in 2003 and 4 on these specific media ownership rules, and a better day eventually came. But it's an uphill battle, and there's big money. But I tried to emphasize at the outset of our conversation that more than the big companies, I am encouraged by the amount of popular grassroots participation now.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Michael Copps, in terms of media consolidation and the monopolies getting more powerful, what did you make of the Sinclair tribute deal? Sinclair is under the radar. People think that Fox News is kind of the Pravda of the Republican
Party. Right.
Sinclair is the most rabid right-wing operation. They're openly rabid about their right-wing politics.
Well, this is one of the most threatening and dangerous companies in the country that nobody has ever heard of. You know, it doesn't have the cachet of NBC or CBS or ABC or Fox or anything like that. Nobody's heard of it. But all the while, it's been gathering more and more stations, and now it's on the cusp of exceeding the national audience cap that's been set, and to have like 250 some stations around the country. And it comes, as you say, with an agenda. It comes with a lot of ideology and right-wing content, and at the expense of the local stations, at the expense of probably getting rid of a lot of reporters and journalists in those local community stations, and churning out editorials from the home office that then tell all the stations to run, and then you get stories like Swift Boat and all the others. So this deal should be dead on arrival at the FCC, but my guess is that under the new majority there, they'll probably pass it.
Well,
let's hope not. Let's hope people write in on that too. You know, these are co-joined issues: net neutrality, media ownership. We have one media ecosystem. Part of it is traditional media. Part of it is the new media, the internet. And both of them have really serious problems, and both of them are not yet serving the full interests of the country. And the internet, to do that, needs to continue to be open, to continue to, although there's already been too much consolidation, but to try to avoid that, but just to make sure that the people have the access to that and can get the news and information they need from that.
Well, Michael Copps, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for covering the issue like you do.
Thank you, Michael. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, and he currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and producer Clemence Penard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.